First of all, I won't use any of high tech, even low tech. I will use only the Blackboard today. And I feel really humbled in a sense because I don't really work on granular material. These days I mostly work on things related to bio-inspired things. However, it turns out that the notion of jamming or jumped matter appears in a very unexpected places, and if it will be time later, maybe next week, maybe a couple of weeks from now, I will be willing to share with you one story of relationship between jamming and DNA, and well, there is one. Today I will give a talk which will be in many senses probably will repeat many talks which some of you already seen in this gathering. And it deals with statics of granular matter. Actually, the story begins almost here in the founder's room, something like 7 years ago, when there was a previous ITP, there were no KITP at that time, meeting which was called Jamming in Rheology, and the fierce discussion we had in that very room probably generated quite a bit of ideas which are now, let's say, relatively well accepted. What was the situation of the field of granular statics at that time? It turns out that we only at that time people knew pretty much everything they know now. There were a couple of, let's say, exactly three puzzles which really attracted quite a bit of interest from physics community to this problem, and which suggested that granular matter is somewhat different from any other solid or rigid matter we dealt with in the past. So what were the puzzles? Puzzle number one was the presence of the so-called force chains. Unfortunately, the force chains were not quantifiable object at that time, and I guess still is, to a large extent, unquantifiable object. So what is known is that when you compress the granular matter and look at it through a cross polarizer, you see the distribution of stresses in there, and the distribution of stresses looks, well, you can relate it to many things, for example, like lightning in the sky, so something like this. Well, I draw it lousy, but the main things are there is a obvious correlation along a certain line in stress, and this stress is significantly, basically, the stress is carried out by a small fraction of the material, or it appears as if the stress, most of the stress is carried out by a small fraction of the material. And somehow it contradicts our notion of what disordered rigid body should be. We expect that generically it should have some Gaussian distribution of stress with some characteristic value and little bit of deviation from it. So it doesn't appear Gaussian, really. And in fact, there were a second type of experiment which explicitly shown that there is nothing Gaussian really about this stress distribution. This was Chicago experiment on measuring the force, the distribution function of forces, of contact forces. So basically they would take carbon paper and load it with sand. Sand, well, not really sand. Press it, and then they used a fancy calibration technique. Basically, they could relate the size of the spot left on the paper by this carbon paper, and the force applied. Therefore, they could relate the distribution of sizes of the spots to the distribution of forces. And surprise, this is logarithm of distribution function. It looks something like this. Basically, it's exponential. Well, just the contact forces applied to that plane. So you could guess or try to guess what's happening in reality between any two particles. And I guess they had better experiments later on, and basically all the forces follow this exponential trend. And at that time, there in Chicago, they had a nice theory due to Sue Coppersmith, known as Q model, which sort of explained this exponential profile. The theory is absolutely ingenious in the sense that, well, it's very simple. So the Q model, I guess I will go that way. So Q model basically says that, well, there is this force applied to the particle. The force is really just a scalar in this model, it's just vertical force. And the particle is put on other particles, and the way how this force is redistributed between the two particles underneath is stochastic. So basically, a fraction of this force goes to the left particle, a fraction goes to the right particle. So here, log B, Q times F, or times F. And here will go 1 minus Q times F. And then, of course, there is another particle, and so on. So there is this projection a process going on from one layer to another. So if you know all the forces here and all the forces here, and there is a matrix which relay them, and turns out that generically, for the particular choice of Q, or the distribution of Q which was flat, so Q was flat between 0 and 1, results in distribution function of forces, which at least, well, large fraction, large, which exhibit this exponential decay. However, it does funny things for small forces, which are pretty much artifact of the model, some of the simplifications of the model.
Isn't a model like that extremely objectionable because it's essentially parabolic propagation?
I would say even more, this model is seriously misleading, but we will come back later. But it is an important point of history. I mean, the Q model was extremely popular, and it gave a sense of false security that you understand something. We, in fact, don't understand anything whatsoever because, for example, the result is not particularly robust. If we choose P of Q, which is different, even this, you won't get the true exponential. We will get exponential somewhere far away, which is not really that interesting. So
what happens is that if you choose the distribution function for Q which has maximum entropy, it returns you maximum entropy distribution for force with subject to constraint of fixed total force.
What do you mean by maximum entropy?
This distribution function corresponds to maximum entropy. It's maximum entropy distribution function. So rho log rho is maximum for it. So this basically the source of mixing. So basically the system forgets about everything except of the constraint that the total force is fixed and generic result for the maximum entropy distribution with a constraint and
exactly is canonical to microcanonical to canonical, right?
Yes, it is. So that is the reason, one of the reasons why Q model happened to work, but it doesn't mean that Q model gives us any reasonable explanation of what is happening there. And as you put it right, well, for one thing, it's basically a diffusive model, and nothing tells us that stress actually diffuses. For one thing, it's not diffusion equation is not reversible, but stress propagation, if such thing exists as stress propagation, should go similarly in both directions. Now, the stress propagation, I already said those words, even though from point of view of classical physics, it's pretty much nonsense. Stress doesn't really propagate in rigid bodies, as we know it. It is governed by equations of elastic theory, which are elliptic. Elliptic equations don't have such thing as propagation. You have to specify the boundary condition everywhere on the boundary, and then you will know the stresses inside. So you cannot just know it here and determine it inside of the body. However, there were this was a puzzle number one, puzzle number two, and there was a puzzle number three, which sometimes was called central deep paradox.
Are you going to go back to puzzle number one? Or?
Yes. Do you want to comment? Actually, do comment and do. We're supposed to have discussion here.
Yeah. As a person who doesn't really work on statics, I want to just clarify this picture that you drew with these force chains.
Yes.
Is that a picture which comes out of experiments which are essentially small?
No. Well, any part of the experiment looked like this. Any part of the body looks like it has this. I didn't tell you that this thing propagates through all the sample. It's not true. It's not true. It's not true. It appears and disappears sometimes. So there is no persistence really across all the system.
Right. So if you have a giant silo.
No.
These kind of things.
No. That doesn't appear to be a divergent Planck scale, really. You just see that well over a substantial number of particles, you have this force chain, but then it sort of dies out.
And another.
Well, as I said, this thing is not particularly quantifiable. You just see that that stress distribution is judged by the cross polarizer experiment. It does appear to be localized within those string-like structures.
You can calculate force polarizing function pretty fast, so that also gives you confidence that it's.
The force correlation function might not be a good object to quantify this, because actually there is more correlation than that would suggest.
That's true, but it's partly, you see more by eye than really maybe there, at least quantifiable.
Right, because it really looks like some string, but string is not really straight, therefore it's not really clear how to construct a mathematical object which will filter those force chains. And then the question is whether the result of such analysis wouldn't be something you already imposed. So I tend to say that this is purely qualitative observation that something string-like and with concentrated forces exists there.
So in the same way, can you give a reference or where I can find these correlations which have been done? I
mean, do you know the correlations?
There's a recent work coming up from Bob Behringer who measured the correlation.
Is it clear that these you see the same sort of thing in a large system? I mean, most of Bob's experiments on these rotating
They're very small. Also did things on bigger systems, but I think
but the force chains tended to span the system in his work that I'm familiar with.
Right. Well, I think the best studies for larger systems are numerical. Mm-hmm. And what you always can do, especially if you do it by eye, is just pick out a force chain and keep on following it, and you end up on the other boundary. But in the meantime, the thing has split off, and other things have come in, and it fluctuates a lot. Right.
Probably depends on the cutoff that you use.
Well, absolutely. So if you change the force, at some point you will have sort of percolation. But that's right. matter of the of the force threshold which you use.
So I think to answer you, I think the evidence numerically is just when you make the thing bigger, and you look at a small patch, it looks exactly the same as a small system. I don't think anybody has figured out how to see a difference between those. So you always see these little loops, and they always occur on the scale of a few grains, and that's it. But if you patch a lot of them together, you can trick yourself and see something which is very long.
But you believe that they exist in a very large geological system, that you still have highly homogeneous stress distribution.
Yes. And I think there's another twist. When you shear the system, they appear to become longer, and what slightly happens there is controversial.
You can actually see these string-like objects numerically as well as in experiment. And we've done theories for them, and I'll refer people to the talk that I'm going to give on these things. But the fact is that they are a complementary way, and you can actually see them without actually having to measure force-force correlation function. You can see them in the structure. So in my view, they're a more appealing demonstration because you can see them visually.
No one really answered the question whether or not if we had a really large system, do we have a connection from here to the body?
Yeah,
that's the question. As I said, it's just how you threshold your force. I mean, if you choose the correct threshold, it will percolate. It's a generic thing. It will do it with always. I mean, it's as I said. Let's not take this picture that seriously. I mean, you cannot. In almost 10 years, we haven't really quantified it, so let's forget about it.
But this maybe another way to think about it. Yeah. Of course, in the end, what you want to get is the stress field.
Yeah.
And so once you know all the contact forces, you then get the stress field, right? And then what you find, for instance, in a shared system, is that your stress field is properly, anisotropic. But if you go to an appropriate length scale over which you average, all this fluctuation disappear. So on a large enough length scale, it just looks more or less like elasticity. So then the concept of a force propagating from one side to the other side doesn't seem to,
True. There is basically a mesh size there, or let's say there is a self-averaging going on there. So,
at a larger length scale, this is a elastic material with a complicated rheological behavior.
No.
Yes.
Okay. Wait. Back up. Don't say what's elastic. We are just getting there. No. Force chain is the signature of something possibly different from elasticity. So let me explain what I mean. And that is puzzle number three, which is the central deep paradox. So if you prepare a sand pile in a very particular manner, you have to pour the material from the center basically, so that there is an avalanche here, and in this way you create a sand pile. There is also some constraints on what kind of support there should be, and so on. But in certain regimes, when this experiment is done, and the force or the load distribution is measured, a very peculiar behavior is observed. So this is the normal load, and this is the position. And the at the center of the sand pile, apparently there is a minimum in this load distribution, and then there is a shrink of maximum forces, and well, it looks a little bit like arching, right? So you basically get a force which gets somehow an element of the sand pile gets supported by an arch going there and there. What was striking is that Claudine, Whitmer, Cates, and Bouchard were able to construct a model which worked remarkably well in describing this force distribution. And the model was extremely simple. It was extremely simple, but almost theoretical. Basically, they said that the local stress here may not be arbitrary, that it should satisfy certain algebraic equation. It's important, algebraic. No derivatives whatsoever. Okay, why do you need this equation? Simply because the fundamental laws of physics do not fix the way how the stress is distributed. The fundamental law of physics basically tells me that, depends whether you like or not to follow the covariance and contravariance, but okay, we won't. It basically says you that the divergence of stress is equal to local force per unit volume. So that's all it says. But there are D equations like this in D-dimensional space. However, the stress field, of course, has much more components. It's a symmetric tensor, therefore it has d times d plus 1 over 2 independent components. Independent components. So some equations are missing, and the way how this lack of equation is solved in classical elastic theory is that the stress is parameterized by displacement field. It is parameterized by strain, and strain is related to displacement field. And displacement field is vectorial field. Therefore, you have D equations for D components of displacement. So elasticity elastic system, and I see ij is ijkl times dkul. This is therefore the problem is mathematically well posed, and it is an elliptic problem. You have to specify either displacements or forces on all the boundaries of the on the whole boundary of the region of interest. And then you will know the stress at the function of position. Now, what these guys did, they basically said that stress is not arbitrary, but it satisfies the following constitutive equation. Then there exists a tensor U which knows something about the local properties of the material, and basically what you get is so-called null stress condition. In other words, they imposed an algebraic constraint on the components of the stress tensor. There are several ways of writing down this condition.
U is supposed to be known?
Yes, U is material property, so it knows something about the packing.
But I mean, you said this is theoretical, but this is what you get with normal Coulomb friction or something, you know?
Hmm?
This is normal for friction in a limiting case.
Why?
Well, it's just the relation between the two principal components of this circuit slipping.
Oh, if you sleep, yes, but that is, there was this old theory, it is really old, of marginally stable state, that almost everything is on the verge of mobility, but it has never been really proven or demonstrated, and neither experiment nor simulation never supported it. So it's...
What's interesting about this is inequality, not an inequality.
It's equality, yes. It is equality.
It holds point-wise?
Hmm?
It holds point-wise throughout the material.
Yes, it is a local condition, which locally depends on the on the way how the system is constructed. Moreover, actually, if you say that U is the same everywhere, you won't be able to explain the central D paradox. Or let's say if you just say that. Well, I put a little bit. Wrong. Let me first explain you how this.
Yes. Just wanted to apply this to the frictional case, not just the frictionless case.
One more time.
D plus one over two thing. The thing that you have with this formalism.
Yes.
This includes friction or not?
This formalism is not a formalism, it's just a postulate.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you anything about where this comes from, and that was a part of the problem. So how does this thing work? Basically, first of all, U is said to be hyperbolic. Therefore, it can be transformed by changing the variables. I can transform U into the following canonical form. Why hyperbolic? Because basically elliptic form of U just results in completely unphysical situation. I guess it just requires zero pressure, something like that. So only hyperbolic results in any physically sound solution.
I thought U
was a vector. U is a tensor. U is a tensor. Uij. 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 Well, if you wish. Yes. So.
Is that a double dot or a single dot?
Come on. Okay. Okay, let's go back to zero to avoid the confusion. So, if you have this similar form, this simple form in certain choice of coordinate, sigma, well, u times sigma then means, basically means sigma xi eta times 2 equals to 0. In other words, sigma xi eta is 0. No off-diagonal term there, which greatly simplifies our equation for stress. So just a reminder, our equation for stress is then becomes split into two independent equations over xi and eta. Basically, this means that I split my problem into two one-dimensional problems. I basically follow along these lines of constant xi and constant theta, and I collect all the force out there, I integrate it. That's it. These things are, of course, called
curves. The supposition that there are lines in which there is zero shear stress, basically, right?
Yes. There is a local choice of coordinates such that there is no... Well, it's not zero shear stress, sorry. The shear stress is not of the diagonal term. The shear stress is something more delicate. The shear stress may appear if you have a difference in two diagonal elements. So shear stress is different invariant. Is an invariant of the choice of the coordinates.
With two different indices, you usually call it shear stress. But
no, it's not. Shear stress is an invariant of the matrix, which may be of the diagonal term, or it may be the difference of the two diagonal terms. So it's
new to me, but that's okay.
So if you have sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 1 is not equal to sigma 2, there is a shear stress there.
Sure, planar strain.
Yeah, well, it's okay. So, anyway, this thing basically travels.
The evolution equation defined CNA, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Basically, the constitutive equation had a very simple geometric interpretation, fixed principal axis. This means that basically, actually it was misleading because mathematically this is not called principal axis. Principal axis is something you do by making an orthogonal transformation of the matrix, and this transformation is not orthogonal. But okay, historically it was called fixed principal axis approach. So basically I have this xi and eta, and the force travels independently along these lines of constant xi and eta, known as characteristics. Of course, there is an alternative way of writing down this equation. It will look exactly like wave equation. And we know the solution of the wave equation basically given by those characteristics. But I just made a shortcut, so I went directly to this characteristic representation. So it basically is, so these are characteristics. One moment. And this all looks like a light cone. Now, in principle, it may change, but there is no reason why in this sand pile it should really change. So they said that, well, basically the system is uniform because each Each point down there is pretty much the same as point out there. I mean, there is no reason why angles should change. There is no fundamental length scale for one thing. Well, except of the grain size, but let's say we're on much larger scales. But then they said different. The axial symmetry is actually not quite there locally. So each point here is not really axially symmetric. Therefore, there is no reason why this xi and eta should be symmetric with respect to this line. No, they said, actually, because of the way how the sand is deposited, there is a tilt. The tilt like this. So there is asymmetry. And because of this asymmetry, they were able to reconstruct this this central dip profile, actually even quantitatively good. The agreement was even quantitatively good. Moreover, they had a prediction that if you deposit the sand in different manner, if you just try not to break the symmetry, this axial symmetry, you locally create a sort of a pancake, and then another pancake, and so on. So you basically, you emulate this sand pile, but you don't prepare this by pouring this from the center. So you basically do it like this. You pour it like this. So basically, do the sand pile this way, the central dip should be gone. So in this case, the two characteristics are pretty much pointing in the same direction, pointed in symmetric manner, and turns out it doesn't give any minimum in the center or the maximum. Indeed, experimentally, that's true. So if you prepare the sand pile in a different manner, you can get rid of the central dip. Okay, that was convincing. However, it was a very ironic situation when physicists basically challenged what we, centuries-old laws of physics, and civil engineers were very reluctant to follow this way. Civil engineers had the combination of good old elastic theory and theory of plasticity, and basically after some time they were able to construct some explanation of the central dip product, because, well, for one thing, they had quite enough fitting parameters. Yes?
I think you even said that this dip and the fact that you didn't have a dip, these were not robust. I think that's one of the things they also said, that you couldn't say that if you made the sand pile, the physicists were saying that if you made the sand pile the way you said, then you wouldn't have a dip, and otherwise you would have a dip. And they even contested that as far as,
obviously the system is very hard to experiment with. It depends on pretty much everything. So one should be very careful when he's doing the experiment. But apparently, when the experiment is done well, the dip is there. So at least here, let's not go too far into discussion. But my problem here is that this constitutive equation looks like nothing we knew before. And that's where this notion of isostaticity come from. Basically,
can I stop you there, because I'm wondering if you're now going to keep on defending this model, or
no,
going
to destroy. No, what was that discussion? What was that discussion in the founders' room about? Basically, Mike Cates was defending his model on almost anyone present would be very unhappy with the need of abandoning the good old physics just for a single experiment. So basically, around that time, we start to realize that there is a loophole, rigid bodies, as we knew them, are not the most general case of rigid bodies. There is a subclass of rigid systems which are not really described by theory of elasticity. That was quite a surprise, really. And I will not try to make a point here that granular material actually is a new type of rigid system. In fact, quite possible it have really nothing to do with isostatic packings, but there are indications that it probably has something to do with it. So what exactly is isostatic packing? It's a very simple thing. The first references to isostatic packing, which at that time was called, the first notion that the granular packing may be isostatic, or at that time it was called minimally connected, probably goes to Sam Edwards, who made this claim that basically if you take particles together, and at some point they stop, they actually get jumped. Right at that point, you have just enough contacts out there, just enough forces to equilibrate all the particles. Therefore, there is a balance between the number of contacts, or number of unknown forces, and number of equations for them. This is the property of isostatic packing. However, that earlier claim was a little bit strong. For example, it would mean that almost any packing of spheres in three dimensions has a coordination number 4. And then I remember this experience of going to a marketplace in Israel and standing like 10 minutes in front of a person who was selling oranges, and right after the talk of Sam Edwards, and I was somewhat surprised to see that actually the real packing of oranges had nothing to do with coordination number 4. Rather, each orange obviously sits on 3 others, therefore the coordination number there is 6. So there was a hidden assumption in Sam Edwards' argument, and that assumption was infinite friction. So if you allow for some sliding to occur, well, you can have more contacts than there are constraining equations. However, turns out that when there is no friction, then you can claim that the packing is either isostatic, or should I call it generalized isostatic? But let me start with a simple case: no friction and spherical.
Requirement that you have to make infinite friction?
Okay, there are two limits, zero friction and infinite friction. In both limits, the claim is that you will have isostatic packing.
But if you build a heap of oranges, they can have any friction.
Oranges for practical purposes are zero friction case.
You have no history in the system.
Oh no, that actually is not a serious constraint. It might be a serious constraint for the infinite friction system. However, if you really have an infinite friction system, it is extremely hard to imagine what kind of
processing need. Well, maybe if you do it sequential packing, then you're right. With infinite friction, you can construct non-isostatic packing. With zero friction, you just cannot.
But you have always some history in the system.
I mean, yes.
If you sequentially build your heat, then you have
no, wait a moment. Wait a moment. I'm saying that the infinite friction problem has this difficulty. You depend on history. Zero friction doesn't really have this problem. With zero friction, it's invariant property of the.
You want to say that if you have infinite friction, that you have a chance to get the heat. This is Gordon number four.
I don't want to say anything about infinite. Well, I don't want to say anything about infinite friction anyway in my talk later, because, well, basically infinite friction is not really a practically important case for one thing, and it's indeed has all these difficulties. So I don't want to defend the infinite friction case. I basically want to make my point about the zero friction case, and moreover, I will even limit myself to spheres. Non-spherical particles, it is believed that non-spherical particles pose some problem to this isostatic packing concept, but in fact they don't. Just makes things a bit messy, but conceptually it's still there. What do we have with spheres? With spheres,
to clarify that infinitely rigid spheres, right?
Infinitely rigid, absolutely. That's important. Yes. So no friction. Infinite rigidity. So you see, as always with those physicists, we took all those important facts and threw them away. We just wanted a clear system where we could see that something might go wrong with our regular theory of elasticity, and indeed it went wrong. So, if you take this system and then ask a very simple question, what will be the coordination number, or the topology of the system, what will be the coordination number of the system? And the answer is, you will have just as many contacts as many you need to determine all the force, to prevent the system from motion. So basically, each particle will have some number of neighbors, and number of equations of force balance is d dimensionality times number of particles. Number of unknown, that is number of unknown contact forces, all of them are just numbers because all forces in frictionless system are normal forces. So number of those forces is z coordination number divided by 2 times n. So z times n over 2. This 2 counts for double counting. Z average. So this is average coordination . Okay, I wasn't good in explaining the logic of the theorem which I'm trying to prove. So you basically do two counting. First, you count the number of geometrical constraint and try to find out the position of all the particles. So geometrical counting. you have d times n unknown positions of the coordinates of the particles. And you have equations, the constraint equations like this also. That the distance between the centers of two particles in contact should be equal to sum of the radii. Therefore, this will only be solvable if, so the number of such equations, is coordination number times n over 2. So here I have dn unknown and coordination number n over 2 constraints. Here I have just the opposite. This is force counting. So if I have this, from this geometrical counting, I can conclude that number of constraint may not, of independent constraint may not exceed the number of variables. Therefore, if all these equations are independent, then Zn over 2 should be less or equal than dn. Similarly, if all these equations are independent here, I have the opposite inequality. I know that Zn over 2 is more or equal than dn. Therefore, if all these equations of constraint here and here are mutually independent, then the only way how the system can be realized and be rigid, so both geometric and force balance equations are satisfied, is if Z is equal to 2D, which is the case when you just have enough information to determine all the forces just from force balance equation. You don't really need to know the displacements. Now, I said, well, you need independent equations. In principle, you might invent the cases when equations are not independent. The classical case is just rigid, close packing. But these cases are what is called measure zero events. If you allow now some disorder in choice of sizes of the particles, you will immediately lose part of your context so that the system will become isostatic. So this is a proof that the system with infinitesimal and disorder and with rigid particles, rigid spherical particles, is isostatic. You have just enough context to determine all the forces. To determine all the forces without introduction of the displacement field.
It's a quick question. Why do you call it the average correlation number?
Why not? It's average correlation number.
No, but I mean.
Average number of nearest neighbors.
But does individual particles have less than that?
Yes, of course. They are not all have the same number of nearest neighbors.
So then, how is the force balance for those particles?
Oh, it's a global thing. It's not that you can determine all the forces for this particular particle just by looking at force balance of this particular particle. No, you have to write down all the equations. You have to write down all the equations and then determine all the forces. It's a global problem. And that's part of what I will tell you in a moment. If you take now the part of the system and repeat this counting, I will not go through this, but if you're... And repeat this counting for the part of the system you can ask, suppose I have an external contacts, and I can ask how many of those external forces should be specified in order to know the all the forces inside of this subsystem. The answer is in the limit of large enough subsystem, exactly half of the external force have to be specified in order to know all the forces inside.
As long as I understand, I have the feeling that the properties of your system, I would expect them to depend very much on the fluctuations of the coordination number.
No, why? First of all, the coordination number is not.
But that is going to be related with the way you prepare the system, and then in the way.
No. Look. You cannot have that much of fluctuation of coordination number on the large scale. I mean, if you take a subsystem which consists of hundreds of particles, the chances are that almost obviously you will have deviation bounded by square root of this number. So I just rely on the fact that I have many particles out there, so it's totally self-averaged.
I mean, for instance, if you change the density of the system by migrating it.
Yes.
The change in density is going to be very much related with the change in the local coordination.
No, not in this system. Not in this system.
You can compact
the system, but you cannot change coordination number. There is no one-to-one correspondence between density and coordination number. But of course, there is probably a deterministic relationship between them when you are under stress. Okay. So what I'm saying is that if you don't have a constraint of non-tensile forces, then you can prepare in principle a system of coordination number 2D with various compactness. It's obvious. You just can't construct them. You can get different densities, but
they're not generic. The question you're talking about generic packing. So the question is
No. I don't know what generic packing is. You can prepare the system in different manner. You can make it sequential. You can fast freeze it. There is no such thing as generic preparation.
But I think for large systems. For this particular case, you find that your packing density becomes closer and closer to random box packing.
Absolutely. You probably are right. But
you cannot really change the density.
I'm tending to say that if I want, I can prepare my system close to real closed packing density. Right, I just construct a closed pack system, and it's just a proof of principle that with the same coordination number you may have a variety of densities. That's it.
Well, I think this is all true when you have friction, but in this particular
I don't see any relationship to friction. I mean, just take a hexagonal. Anyway, it's totally unrelated to compaction, really, at the moment. As you'll see, there is some aspect. What I'm trying to say, yes.
We can take a break.
We can, yes, if you wish.
5 minutes and we'll come back to
you. Okay.
So let me finally finish with things which are more or less settled and go to things which are not. So what I'm trying to say is that if I take a subsystem and count how many forces should I know, how many external forces should I know in order to know all the forces inside, for isostatic packing you need to know exactly half. Well, in average, half of those forces, which supports, in principle, the hyperbolic, the idea of hyperbolic stress constitutive equation or hyperbolic equation for stress. Now, if I take basically the pancake of Santa, the claim is that if I know the forces applied to the top layer, and by some reason I know that the network is fixed, I know the geometry of the network, I will know the forces underneath, which is already looks very much like the stress propagation with McLaughlin and Cates proposed, and looks a little bit like Q model. However, as you see, I haven't derived the constitutive equation yet. I will in the moment. I will basically say that if I take any cross section of the material, any cross section, for example, and determine the average force here, which is sigma times n, this force determines all other components of the local stress, right? If I know the force, the average force in this cross section, I know all other forces underneath and above. Therefore, I know the local stress. So the stress is related to just this three component or d components of stress. In other words, the stress can be parametrized by just three numbers in three dimensions, or two numbers in two dimensions. Since this relationship obviously should be linear, I can write down sigma ij tau ijk times fk, where fk is essentially this force applied to a particular cross section. It doesn't matter for me which cross section to take. It will just renormalize this force. So I have this constitutive equation, which in 2D is equivalent to the constitutive equation of Cates and company, and it generalizes it. So it's now good for any dimension, because I have just one coordinate and one unknown, this f. And it doesn't matter for me what this f is, because what matters for me is only stress. This tau should depend on the local geometry of the packing.
Question.
Yes.
Bush and company had a multiple scattering version of that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is your
yes, of course.
Thing,
you,
is your thing here also valid for that?
That is a very interesting question. Basically, it amounts to my next question mark, to which actually I don't have an answer. And I don't believe the multiple scattering picture actually answers this. And the problem is like this. Any hyperbolic equation, either this or two-dimensional case of Shire company, is always breaks a spherical symmetry. It is inconsistent with the spherical symmetry of the system. But it's not true that isostatic packing need to be with broken spherical symmetry. You can construct isostatic packing with preservation with the preservation of the spherical symmetry. So what will be the Cassidy equation then? Actually, I don't know. I can tell myself that locally probably spherical symmetry is always broken, but I can always have domains with different orientations of, let's say, this standard tau, so that in general it diverges out. Probably this problem is absolutely academic, because in reality, if you prepare your system in gravity, you always break this the spherical symmetry. Even if you prepare your system in vacuum in space in microgravity, you still have the front propagation when you create a rigid rigid domain, right? You have a direction of deposition. So in a sense, you always have the direction of the first stress applied. However, it doesn't say that, well, once again, for the purpose of argument, you can construct an isostatic packing with isotropic, with completely isotropic isostatic packing. I don't know what the equations will be. Probably it's something diffusive. Probably. Basically, what will happen is you locally will have those characteristics, but then essentially you have to average over the possible directions. So as you go away, there is certain persistent length of this characteristic. It will make all kind of random walks, and that better be in dimensionality larger than 2. And then basically it's sort of this the stress will sort of diffuse away from the origin. So the Green function will look a bit diffuse, but don't take my word for this, I never really calculated. So it is an interesting question just from academic perspective.
Excuse me, I can't write my fault, but who is this little f here in this institution?
It doesn't matter. I said that the this f has a meaning of this force.
So you said sigma is proportional to f, and f is a doesn't
matter. I'm saying that if I have sigma, which has sigma x y, sigma x z, then sigma y x, sigma y, sigma z, etc.
Yeah.
And I can only take these three numbers and reconstruct the rest. So that's my claim.
But is this f the same as the divergence of that sigma?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it has not. No. Okay, let's call it g. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. it's not that. Not that. Absolutely.
Okay. Say there is something.
So the equation of motion for stress will be then divergence of this tau I j k g k is equal to f j. So that will be it. You will be able to find out the vector g, and from that reconstruct the stress seems.
So you assume there exists some vector g.
Yeah, exists some vector g, vector potential.
Sorry?
Vector potential.
Okay.
Okay. And
but it's and third order tensors are unusual in
materials.
You can't in isotropic medium.
No, you cannot. That's a point. This equation and actually the null stress equation, the fixed principle x, they are all inconsistent with isotropic medium. You cannot construct any of this equation in the isotropic medium. That is a puzzle I feel trying to promote. Another thing. Another thing is, go back to Q model. Where the exponential force distribution comes from? And actually, that is very easily be now
understand in terms of if we know something about isostatic bed. So if I have an isostatic bed, then for a large ensemble, I know that all the forces which come into my system totally determine the force which will come out. So all these contact forces, F1, F2, Fn, determine F1 prime, F2 prime, Fn prime. In average, there is even the same number. And now, you do this. You take you construct a sort of a phase space consisting of all the forces incoming into the system. Four fixed networks. F1, F2, F3.
Those are G's, right?
To Fn.
Those are G's.
No. Here it's simple contact forces. Okay. These are just contact forces. And what I'm saying is that if the system is isostatic, that there is a one-to-one correspondence between the point in this space and the point in another space. So there is a deterministic mapping, one point to another. Just another way of putting what I just said. A small region here will be entered to small region here.
How do you know that this stays compact?
All equations are continuous, so I can basically say that the mapping is continuous, and infinitesimal region here will map it to infinitesimal region there. Even though, of course, if I deviate sufficiently far from this point, I will induce the change in topology of the network because I don't want tensile forces out there, and this space has to be changed. But that doesn't matter. Suppose I already know the topology, which is consistent with all with the requirement of no tensile forces, and what I'm saying is that the infinitesimal region from here will be mapped into infinitesimal region here.
Sorry, I do not believe that because, I mean, you can think about the system is large enough. You can think about a small deviation which leads to the creation of contact.
That depends on how you take the limits.
No.
I'm saying I take a large but finite subsystem. I take rigid boundaries. I take a 1,000 particle layer, and I measure all the forces that are coming into the system. Then I'm saying, if I know the topology of the network, and I know that the system is isostatic and no frictional force, if all these ifs are required, then I can tell you what the contact forces are underneath. And now what I'm saying is that if I a little bit really infinitesimally change the forces around this value originally, there is a region of stability that doesn't create a new context in this, or doesn't destroy a context in this pancakes made of 1,000 particles. So that's my claim. If so, this reminds us of something, namely of Poincaré cross sections. I could also make an analogy to just regular motion in phase space, but. This is obviously a discrete mapping, and it's better to relate this to Poincaré cross-section. And the only thing which I also need is an analogy of Flügel theorem. The claim that that the phase volume is preserved by this transformation. It is not preserved, but it is preserved in average. So in average, if you repeat this mapping many, many, many times, there is no reason why there should be a trend toward decrease or increase of the phase volume, because the inverse is also possible. So because of this inversibility, when we're going up or down, in average, the phase volume should be conserved, in average. If you have a process with preserving the phase volume, but presumably extremely chaotic, so some of the Lyapunov exponents are positive, some are negative, you generically will fill out the allowed phase volume, and we have the constraint. We have a constraint of the total stress being fixed. You will get exponential distribution of forces.
But you look at a pure exponential probably, right?
No, it's delicate, because you fix the stress, and those contact forces actually are distributed in a fancy manner. So you should take into account that basically the overall vector of the incoming force is preserved. So it will be modified exponentially, modified by some projection factors. But what I'm saying is that there were a couple of works in terms of Abbasque who basically make these claims of analogy to Gibbs-Boltzmann distribution of this exponential profile. But I guess they largely miss the importance of this hyperbolic stress paradigm. If you just have basically, Vest would say that the system has a maximum randomness, and then you would get this exponential profile. But this maximum randomness is a little bit hard to quantify, and we know that if I have an elliptic system, just regular elastic system, there is nothing like exponential profile there. There is no projection.
All your arguments are for strictly isostatic systems.
Absolutely.
If you do an experiment, you don't have an isostatic system. So,
okay.
We
are coming to the last and most important point. How important this is for practice? Actually, I frankly don't care, but but I want to make several claims. First, the isostatic regime is by no means a singular limit. It's not a singular limit in the when you vary the friction, and it's not a singular limit if you vary the shape of the particle. Why am I saying that it's not a singular limit when you vary the friction? So basically, I'm saying that this is a legitimate zero-order approximation for frictional system. If you now switch on friction and say that it's small parameter. So what will happen when you load a frictional system?
One quick question about before you erase those things. I didn't see the necessary connection between this picture and the cube you introduced before in terms of the vector potential. Is there one or not?
No. They all originate from the notion of isostatistics. I mean, I said that there are a couple of results which you can draw from this isostatistic argument.
Right. But this isn't derived from any constitutive modeling. This picture you just described here, does it?
No, they're not related to the constitutive model, but the constitutive model can sort of follow.
The constitutive model would give the mapping that you...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. No. Constitutive model is coarse grain model, and this mapping is microscopic. But they both sort of follow from some fundamental projection mathematics.
And yeah, I didn't mention this, but we did quite extensive numerical study. I forgot to say this, but that's interesting, that when you load the system, when you prepare the system randomly, randomly positioning and try to make an arbitrary packing, and then apply some force, miraculously, the two characteristics choose the orientation such that they are perpendicular. They are orthogonal. Turns out that it's not particularly unexpected. This basically means that if I press the system in this direction, then sigma yy will be equal to sigma xx. In general, you may have different coefficients, maybe some coefficient tau. Okay, what I'm saying is that if you have a symmetric case and you have two characteristics at certain angle, then if this is x and this is y, this condition of sigma xi eta being zero results in the condition of proportionality between sigma yy and sigma xx with certain coefficient alpha. So this is the general no stress condition for the packing with right-left symmetry. However, what simulations show us is that alpha is equal to 1. And why is it equal to 1? Because, as you point out, when you press the system, it tries to get to local maximum of density. If it gets it to local maximum of density, then look what's happening. Okay, I stopped at some point, but now I allow for virtual motion. I allow this walls to move a little bit and this wall to move down a little bit.
Is this with or without friction? Sorry.
It's without friction. It's without friction. Sorry, it's still without friction. I just back up to say this. So basically, I have. The work done by this virtual transformation, when I just allow the two balls to move, is sigma xx times u xx and sigma yy times u yy. Times area x times area y. So it turns out that sigma xx equals to sigma yy corresponds to the case when this virtual transformation results in no net change of volume, which is to be expected if you get to the extreme to the local minimum of volume. Then of course this small transformation shouldn't change your volume. So this is the signature that we got as dense as we could without making a global rearrangement. So that was basically, after this, the constitutive equation is determined up to, there is no indeterminacy in constitutive equation except of the case when you have a broken symmetry. So if you have a broken symmetry, you have to choose the in the preferred direction, then you know everything. But let's go back to the frictional case, and that will stop there. So if I have a friction, I have a packing. And I apply some extra force there. What will be the response of the system? First of all, if you take into account all the frictional forces, the system is not isostatic. You
you probably have much more contact than you need. Therefore, you construct just regular elastic theory. You say that, well, there are
displacements. You relate displacements. Delta sigma will be related to displacement fields. You plug it into the force balance equation. You calculate the change in all forces. But then what happens is, let's go back to my phase space picture, except that now I will have the all forces, not only the normal, so the frictional forces also. So this will be my elastic response. So I start here, I apply some external stress, I change all the forces, but then there is an inequality which doesn't allow your frictional forces to exceed the friction coefficient times normal force. This limits some region, open region in that space. So when you hit this wall, the sliding occurs. So that elastic stress actually gets relaxed to something else. It depends on already on the model, but it basically gets relaxed somewhere inside of that region. So then you load it more, and again, first there is an elastic response, then there is a slip. So there is a stick slip motion, which all the time remains within this region, given by the inequality, by the inequality that frictional force times normal force. So if you take friction coefficient to sufficiently small, you will be within a small vicinity of the result for the for zero friction case, which proves that the isostatic model gives a legitimate zero order approximation for the frictional system.
Just a question: would that fact that it's restricted to local neighborhoods still be true when you limit to very dense vacuums? Because there you can imagine that the volume that you've drawn would be much larger. You could have a correlated region of rearrangement if you're in the limited dense vacuum. A big correlation.
Oh, sure. What I'm saying is completely different. I mean, it's mathematicians way of pointing this, even though I'm not a mathematician. So I'm just saying the following. How bad is my solution for isostatic pegging? Right. And what I'm saying is that if sliding occurs very often, if my friction is really bad, well, oranges are not a bad example, then basically all this extra stress which originates from friction being there is a small correction to what we know about the statistics. That's why isostatics probably works beyond just a pure mathematical case of
frictional. And my question is that statement that you're making, which I agree with completely,
yes,
if it's reasonably dense vacuums, but in the limit of very dense vacuums, it's just a small correction.
The friction is small correction.
Yes.
If friction coefficient is small, it is small. That's my point. I mean, what I'm saying, I guess, in the limit of dense vacuums, even more so, because you most definitely will be an isostatic limit for the coordination number. The larger coordination number, more likely you have you're close to the coordination number, to the critical coordination number. But what I'm saying is that
at the same time, small deviation displacements can cause long range fluctuations in your coordination number.
I don't believe so. I mean, what my claim is that if I have friction coefficient 10 minus 2, then there is no way you will get a large, a large change in forces compared to the calculation which totally neglects friction.
Okay.
That's basically my claim.
Okay.
Do you lose your version of the Liouville theorem by this? Because now you can have serious reorganizations of particles without changing the mapping of the force.
No, not really. Not really. You see, I basically can split my stress into two. On stress of purely normal forces. So I make a calculation as if there is no friction out there, and apply everything I know, and then say there is a correction, basically plastic correction due to friction.
What I mean is something else. I mean, by if you use stresses and you have your transformation as shown there, it means you stay always in the vicinity of your original point.
But the original point diffuses.
No, no, does not mean that the point has the same volume on the other side.
No. Because basically the point itself gets transformed. So even without friction, this central point, so to speak, it's not a point. As I said, it's an open region.
Yeah.
So that's an open region. Just
open but small and localized. Yeah?
Right. So if I only collect the normal forces here, there would be no constraint whatsoever for them, except that they should be positive. If I add the frictional forces, they are constrained. So if this is normal force, there is no constraint. If this is a frictional force, it should be less than this thing. So what I'm saying is that if I now project along this axis of zero friction, I will get my previous picture. But in fact, I'm allowed sometimes to wiggle a little bit here until I hit this fall.
I understand, but what I'm afraid is that your mapping from one direction to the other one gets lost.
No, because it deals with subspace, only with space of normal forces, and then nothing really happened. So this is an extra dimension. This is extra dimensional frictional force. I don't care about them. I'm trying to say that for small friction, I can neglect them at all. And with normal forces, so all that argument is still holds.
That's,
yeah,
that we can discuss afterwards.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, great. So let's thank our speakers.